Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. It's good to have you with us. Now, to understand the present, it's important to revisit the past. On October 7th, 2001, President George W. Bush addressed the American people.
The oppressed people of Afghanistan will know the generosity of America and our allies. As we strike military targets, we will also drop food, medicine, and supplies to the starving and suffering men and women and children of Afghanistan. We did not ask for this mission, but we will fulfill it.
Almost 15 years later, on July 6, 2016, President Obama addressed the American people.
We pushed al-Qaeda out of its camps, helped the Afghan people topple the Taliban, and helped them establish a democratic government. We dealt crippling blows to the al-Qaeda leadership. We delivered justice to Osama bin Laden. And we trained Afghan forces to take responsibility for their own security.
More than 5 years after that, yesterday afternoon, President Biden addressed the American people.
Here's what I believe to my core. It is wrong to order American troops to step up when Afghanistan's own armed forces would not. The political leaders of Afghanistan were unable to come together for the good of their people, unable to negotiate for the future of their country when the chips were down. They would never have done so while U.S. troops remained in Afghanistan, bearing the brunt of the fighting for them.
In two decades, the office of the president has shifted from suggesting under President Bush that the Afghan people needed the U.S. military to save them, to claiming under President Obama that the United States military did save the Afghan people, to arguing under President Biden that the U.S. military can't be expected to save the Afghan people who don't seem to have the will or courage to save themselves. But none of these presidents expressed what I heard from former Afghan interpreter Amadullah Siddiqui when we spoke last week.
Well, first of all, these are unsung heroes, and they were so close to our American veterans. And most of the American veterans, they feel so bad for their, friends, for their colleagues down in Afghanistan. We were working shoulder to shoulder with the U.S. Army. We were on a battlefield together. We had the same uniform in most of the time, and we were in fighting directly with the insurgents, with the Taliban. We were a soldier with them. Beside being an interpreter, beside being a linguist, we were a soldier. We have many instances that our interpreter saved too many American lives, our soldiers' lives. We had the same duties as the U.S. Army had. And we were the frontliner. We went to, district into district, talking to people and explaining their needs and interpreting their needs and telling them to our soldiers. So we were the frontliner all the time.
Far from the Oval Office, the Afghan people are not helpless victims or heartless cowards. They are allies who spent two decades battling for their own nation, future, and families while incurring unimaginable costs. With me now is James Mirvaldis, who is chairman of No One Left Behind and a former Army non-commissioned officer who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Melissa.
Also joining me is Kristen Rouse, board member of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. She is an Army veteran who served in Afghanistan in 2006, 2010, and 2012. Thank you for being here, Kristen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Kristen, let me begin with you. How are you doing right now, given everything that's transpired in the last few days in Afghanistan?
Well, it's been several days, I'm sure, as James can attest, not a lot of sleep, a lot of communications with folks on the ground who are just crying out for help, to not be abandoned, to not be left behind, for us to fulfill our promise of bringing them with us. We made promises to our translators saying that they can get a visa to come to the United States because they served alongside us, because they wore our uniform, because they risked their lives just as we did, and they are heroes. And we made promises.
Kristen, based on what you're saying, what do you make of President Biden's speech?
I take no issue with withdrawing troops. We've been told for years that there was no military solution in Afghanistan, and troops should have come home long ago. But the catastrophe that is unfolding right now, the tens of thousands of Afghans, our allies, our translators, folks who worked in government, journalists, aid workers, everyone who took part in a democratic, modern, developing Afghanistan, their lives are at risk right now. And they know it. They are being hunted down door to door by Taliban. And we have left them. We have left them, and they are desperately trying to get out. They are messaging veterans. I'm just one of countless veterans who are hearing from everyone we ever knew in Afghanistan right now. People are desperate, desperate to get out.
James, obviously this is the work that your organization has been trying to do. I know that your interpreter was one of the lucky ones who did manage to make it here to the U.S., but how long did that take?
That took 3 years, and he had a spotless case. He had a letter of a certificate of appreciation from Ambassador Cunningham at the time. He had 6 passed polygraph tests. When we got to year 3, I reached out to Senator Tim Kaine's team and asked them as a constituent to follow up with the State Department. And they did so every 90 days until we finally got an answer. My interpreter was sitting in administrative processing for well over a year. And Melissa, just a couple points. I really appreciated you bringing up the past speeches from our presidents. And when this all happened, God, I have to go back. I think I was 17 when 9/11 happened, about to turn 17. And there's a quote in President Bush's speech that you read where he finishes the speech and says, "We will not waver, we will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail." For the last 10 years, I personally have just been trying to struggle with whether we have wavered, we have tired, we have faltered, and I think as a country we have, but I'd always hold out hope that we hadn't failed yet until Sunday. So it's heartbreaking. Veterans like Kristen are just being inundated right now. And to that point, this is hitting the veteran community in a disproportionate manner than the rest of America. Representative Ruben Gallego had a very, very insightful post that he's suffering just like all the other Afghan veterans out there, worried about their interpreters, feeling helpless. But he noted the silence he's hearing from his constituents. So this is good. This is an incredible highlight of this civilian military divide that our country is now enduring. And there are significant questions that need to be asked as we go forward.
James, I so appreciate that perspective because, you know, there's been a lot of criticism, but one of the things I feel like we haven't criticized is ourselves, right? As an American population, I mean, for you to say that you were 17 when 9/11 happened just hit me in a particular way, because the idea that we have sent our sons and our daughters and our husbands and our wives and our parents to Afghanistan for 20 years, and we seem to have taken our eyes off of what was happening there until this moment. James, is there a way that we can still rescue this sense of failure? Is there a way we can still succeed?
Yes, Melissa. We had a great success at the end of June. A family arrived. They were one of the last ones to get a visa prior to the embassy shutting down again from COVID. So they arrived in Dulles, and we took this incredible picture of a 3-year-old girl who had no fear in her eyes. It's one of my favorite pictures from what we're doing. And I bring that up because that's mission accomplished. I know the White House had previously said there would be no mission accomplished moment in Afghanistan. Well, personally, just being able to bring a family over here, navigate the 14-step interagency process that had no leadership up until Ambassador Jacobson was appointed to lead it. That's the takeaway, and that's where, as veterans, we won't fail our allies. The biggest issue here now, obviously, is getting families out. No One Left Behind flew five families, about 30 people out commercially. Just for your listeners, we take exception with the president's two statements that there were SIVs that wanted to stay in Afghanistan. The reason they, to quote the president, had not exercised their right to come to America was that they were waiting to hear from the embassy about evacuation and had not. They could not afford the $5,000 to $10,000 it cost in an airfare ticket. So we stepped in and we're paying for that. We had another 50 families scheduled to fly out this week before everything shut down.
Kristen, help our audience to understand how much danger our allies are in right now, but also how much danger they understood as they were taking on this task and the reason that the promise mattered.
Taliban are saying a lot of things right now that I hope are true, that there is an amnesty, that they are not going to harm people, and so on and so on. But we know from the last 20 plus years that the Taliban, as a characteristic, has lied. I hope they are not lying now, as they have over the last 20 years. We have seen executions in Kandahar already. I've spoken with a veteran tracking a dear friend of hers on the ground outside of Kabul, who they were internally displaced persons corralled by Taliban, and then she lost touch with them. So Taliban are tightening up checkpoints all across the country. They control all of the border crossing points. As far as I understand from the messages that I'm getting, the airport is the only way out for anybody who is identifiable as having worked for the United States. When Taliban captured all of the bases and took all of the equipment, to include equipment that the U.S. had, to include biometric technology, that includes facial recognition and retinal scans. There's a database of everyone, every Afghan who has ever worked for the United States, and they have that. And so these our allies can easily be identified if someone comes door to door or if they try to pass through any checkpoint. And so so a lot of our allies are just they're hunkering down at home. Some are desperate enough to risk their lives out at the airport. And as I messaged with one who was shot at, an interpreter who was shot at yesterday, trying to get desperately to get out. But the controlled movement, you know, but no one can get passports right now. Nobody can get a visa right now. Banks are out of money. They can't even get cash. There are food shortages. There is a massive humanitarian crisis happening, and our allies and all Afghans are caught in this. But the ones who have targets on their heads are those who have worked for the U.S., who have worked in journalism, who have worked in aid organizations, who have worked in government. Educators have been assassinated already. This has been a continuation of what the Taliban has done over the last 20 years. This has been just an escalation of what the Taliban has been doing to Afghan leaders who have been risking their lives for the last 20 years.
Kristen Rouse, board member of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and James Mervaldis, chairman of No One Left Behind. Thank you both for your service, and thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Bye.